So far, the collapse of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac has cost taxpayers nearly $150 billion. Depending on what happens to the housing market, that number could get much higher. But there is a smaller number, relatively smaller, that's drawing attention, $160 million. That's how much taxpayers have spent on legal fees to defend the mortgage giants and their former executives against pending lawsuits, as NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
If you have a mortgage, there's a good chance Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac had something to do with it. The firms buy mortgages from banks, bundle them up into securities, and sell those securities off to investors. Throughout the past decade, these firms and their top executives made some huge mistakes, bad investments, bad decisions. In September 2008, the two massive firms became the responsibility of U.S. taxpayers. And so did their legal fees. Since the government took over Fannie and Freddie, those fees have totaled more than $160 million.
The fact that we are still paying those legal fees is a great concern to me, and it should be concerned to the American taxpayers.
Congressman Randy Neugebauer is a Texas Republican who heads the subcommittee that oversees Fannie and Freddie. He requested the information about legal fees from the firm's regulator and then released the information.
It brings the question what other things are going on over there that might not be in place to minimize the taxpayers' exposure.
Fannie Mae has racked up most of the legal fees, and most relate to accounting irregularities that go back more than 10 years. Since the government stepped in, the firm has accumulated some $24 million in legal fees just to defend former top executives, including one-time CEO Franklin Raines. The executives are accused of manipulating Fannie's books to boost company profits, which also increased their bonuses. One lawsuit ended in a settlement, with the executives neither admitting nor denying wrongdoing. Other suits remain outstanding. The firm's regulator defends paying the legal fees. And Charles Elson, a professor of corporate governance at the University of Delaware, says there's really no choice.
It's one of these you can feel bad and be angry about it, but in the end, you're not going to change very much, and probably nor should you.
He says almost all contracts for corporate executives include indemnification clauses that say the company will pay legal fees if there's a lawsuit or criminal investigation. Otherwise, no one would take these sorts of jobs.
Bottom line is, until a court says that these people have acted badly, the company and obviously its owners, the taxpayers, are on the hook.
Taxpayers are also on the hook for billions of dollars worth of bad loans, backed by Fannie and Freddie at the height of the housing bubble. Philip Swagel is a professor of public policy at the University of Maryland.
I would say the most important thing now is to resolve the situation of Fannie and Freddie so that there are not more losses.
How to resolve that situation is at the heart of heavy debate among bankers and policy wonks in Washington and beyond. The Treasury Department is required to come up with a plan for the future of the two firms by the end of this month. But an administration official has confirmed Treasury will miss that deadline. The official says the administration's policy is still being worked out, but the plan will call for the government to have a smaller footprint in the housing market, with private capital coming back in and taking a larger share. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
All Things Considered continues in a moment.
Finally, we've talked a lot about health issues today, many involving women and girls. Now, I have a few words about missing girls, those we seem to care about and those we don't. I was thinking about this as I made the mistake of trying to use my house phone last night. I don't know how I managed to forget this after 10 years of marriage. During every Pittsburgh Steelers football game, my husband, a Pittsburgh native, insists on commandeering the phone so he and his 7 siblings can call each other and discuss the plays. It is so annoying. Deprived of my phone, though, I started to think about a mother who is probably jumping every time her phone rings because she doesn't know where her child is. Can I just tell you, it's become almost a cliché, the faces on the milk cartons, the breathless reports on the news. But it doesn't change the fact that hundreds of thousands of people go missing each year in this country. In 2008, that number was close to 800,000, according to the National Crime Information Center. Nearly 615,000 of those were people under the age of 18. The vigil began almost a month ago on December 28th for a mother named Janice Salas. Her daughter, Felicia Barnes, disappeared while visiting her older half-siblings in Baltimore over the winter holidays. Felicia's 17th birthday came and went on January 12th without a word. Since then, according to local news accounts, all phone calls to her cell phone have gone straight to voicemail, her ATM card has not been used, and her Facebook page has gone quiet. Did I mention those were local news accounts? One of the interesting facets of this story is that it won't shock me at all if you've never seen nor heard this girl's name before now. Her story has been covered some in the national media, but it is by no means getting the wall-to-wall attention that other stories of missing young girls and women have received. Some people wonder why that is. She is, after all, a young girl. The authorities believe that her disappearance involves foul play, in part because she is an honor student at a North Carolina high school, has already been accepted to college, had never been in trouble with the law, and had no unusual disputes with her family. In fact, her mother, long divorced from her father, had agreed to allow her to visit her half-siblings since she felt the teen deserved to know her ex's side of the family. So why isn't her disappearance a bigger deal? She's pretty. That shouldn't matter, but apparently it does when it comes to media coverage of missing persons. And she's African-American, and that shouldn't matter, but apparently it does too. CNN's Don Lemon covered this story and wrote about it on the CNN blog. He said he had heard about Felicia Barnes' disappearance on social media when he was on Christmas vacation, and friends and others started asking why the authorities are not getting more help from the news media in spreading the word. The Baltimore police, interestingly enough, are among those raising the question of whether Felicia's race has something to do with the lack of urgency with which her disappearance has been treated by the media. African Americans make up about 13% of the population, but estimates from different organizations and the Justice Department suggest that black children account for 34 to 42% of all missing people under the age of 18. What is happening to those children? Some of them, according to human rights activist Malika Sadassar, are surely being trafficked for sex. I reached her today to ask her about this story, and she told me about girls who are literally kidnapped off the street, drugged, gang-raped, and deprived of food until they're so desperate and frightened they will do anything. There's even a name for it. It's called guerrilla pimping, and part of the calculation for the pimps involves exactly which girls they think they can hold on to and exploit before somebody comes looking. That is one reason the organization Sadassar co-founded, the Rebecca Project for Human Rights, campaigned to pressure the website Craigslist to shut down its adult services section because they came to believe it made it just too easy for traffickers to connect with buyers. That's also the reason her group is campaigning to get law enforcement to treat underage prostitutes as de facto victims instead of prosecuting them. Sadassar told me that people find it hard to believe that this happens in this country. They can imagine it in Thailand or India or Ciudad Juarez or places like that. They don't think it can happen in Baltimore or Atlanta or Ohio. But her experience and that of other advocates say that it can, and it does. And why wouldn't it, when only some children are seen as worth saving and protecting, and so many others are just invisible? And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. We live in a world of seemingly infinite choices. Press the remote, you can watch documentaries, cartoons, dramas, talent shows. Click the mouse, you can play video games, read news, listen to music, watch movies, or chat with friends. Today, we begin a series on how this fracturing of the media has fundamentally changed the way we experience culture. NPR's Elizabeth Blair gets us started. So what is this called?
The academic word for this is disintermediation.
Casey Ray Hunter heads up the Future of Music Coalition.
But that's a mouthful, so fractured culture works just fine.
Fractured implies that something is broken, it's wounded.
Alyssa Rosenberg writes a column for The Atlantic. She prefers another word.
The fragmentation of culture is a wonderful thing.
And Mark Lopez of the Pew Hispanic Research Center was just confused when I asked him about fractured culture.
I was actually going to ask you what it means. I wasn't sure exactly what it means.
But he took a stab at it, explaining the fracturing he sees in the Latino population.
For example, young Latinos are straddling two different cultures. They're straddling a culture of their immigrant roots, but also an American culture as well.
And what's popular with one group can go virtually unnoticed by another. Univision, for example, is watched by millions of Latinos in the U.S., but millions of other Americans couldn't tell you what channel it's on.
Don Julio! Don Julio, por Dios, ¿qué le pasa? Doña Marcela, ¿qué hacemos?
TV ratings offer glaring proof of how the once mass market has split up into lots of smaller crowds. Since we're not all watching the same shows, those water cooler moments are harder to come by. Dan Schneider, a TV veteran and executive producer for Nickelodeon, says take a show like Modern Family.
Okay, ready? One, two, three.
A really great comedy that's popular and new that's on the air right now.
Nothing's happening!
Oh, my God!
Yeah, our kids walked in on us.
But if you go walk around the streets or if you go walk around a mall and say, hey, did you see last week's Modern Family? You know, how many people out of 10 are going to say, oh, yeah, I saw it? The television markets are so niche that even a popular show isn't watched by, you know, most people that you're going to run into.
There is no one dominant cultural conversation. The music industry, same thing. Casey Ray Hunter of the Future of Music Coalition says this fragmentation has opened up the world for creators and consumers alike.
The arrival of the internet, to some degree, leveled the playing field. And that allowed, a plethora of folks who otherwise would have had no shot of getting on, say, commercial radio to be heard. It's really an amazing time to be a fan.
It's ushering in a totally different era of communications.
Faye Ferguson is co-CEO of Burrell Communications, an African-American ad agency founded 40 years ago.
Based on the principle that black people are not dark-skinned white people.
Ann says, Ferguson, that African Americans are a separate, viable market. She says there have always been many American cultures.
This has always existed, but technology has been an enabler. So that now there's actually a way to get to these smaller groups efficiently.
She says targeted marketing is the name of the game now more than ever. So are we at risk of losing a common culture in such a fractured society? Alyssa Rosenberg of The Atlantic says maybe, but she also thinks it will make us appreciate the mass cultural events that do occur even more, like the end of the Harry Potter series, or when Michael Jackson died.
I wanna make a change for once in my life.
His death affected millions, whether you were a fan or a former fan or just recognized his influence.
It was enormous because we were united in a way that we aren't normally. It added significance to the event.
If Michael Jackson were coming of age now, could he become the king of pop? Probably not. The once monolithic record companies have lost their power. The fractured media has made it easy for people to discover all kinds of new talent, or even learn about artists from other cultures they never knew existed, just by changing the channel. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.